We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From Pod World Headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield IMG College, presented by Harris Teeter, where Tar Heel fans shop for groceries.
We're back. Time for another edition of the Carolina Insider. Jones and Adam here with you. And let me just tell you, if this show was a grocery bag, let's say, Adam, just for giggles, from Harris Teeter, who's assisting you with groceries this basketball season, because each week one winner will receive free groceries for every assist through the Big Four Grocery Assist Sweepstakes. Visit harristeeter.com. Look for the Grocery Assist Sweepstakes section to enter. By the way, the presenting sponsor of the pod. If this was a grocery bag, Adam, it would be overflowing with goodies because of how much we have on this show. Don't you worry. I have not forgotten that today is Friday.
It's Friday, Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Weekend. Partying, partying. Partying, partying. Fun, 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 fun. Looking forward to the weekend.
Adam, on this show, we're going to talk about the Clemson game. That's like spoiled milk from the grocery store.
I'd like to return that for a refund.
We're going to preview the matchup with Duke. That's old reliable there. That's like some delicious potato chips. You always know they're going to be good. Then, Adam, I'm just going to say it. I think a dark horse potty candidate, Kevin Salvadori, a member of the 1993 National Championship team. We talked to Kevin. Awesome stories about his time in Chapel Hill. His family was on Family Feud. That's like the surprise item that you put. Maybe it's like some cheese that you're going to try out. You don't know, but then you have it and it's delicious. We're also going to have the audio of our interview with all-time Tar Heel favorite Marcus Page. He was on the video pod yesterday. Anytime Marcus is involved, we're going to bring that in the mix, of course. And that's one of your favorites, Adam. That's Coca-Cola. One of your favorites right there. So, you come and join us on this cornucopia of a pod.
You could never go through the express lane with this pod.
No.
It's got too many items.
Yeah, sorry. By the way, why is it now, outside of the or the self-check. Mm-hmm. Like, you're going to do the self-check. I mean, obviously. Why is the angle of the line where I need to wait? Mm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Now you're like even with the cashier, but it confuses me as to which line I'm in. Why is it that way?
I'm not sure.
I don't like that at all.
Well, and do you feel as though there is an unspoken limit to the amount of items you can take in the self-check?
Yes, although I can't say I've always followed those rules. And...
well, that's like your life.
Right, yeah. No rules, just right. And I do say the where I get in the most trouble is if all of a sudden I don't have any bag space left.
That's like the worst.
Or if something's too heavy and I don't know where to put it. I don't know, does it stay on the thing? Sometimes the computer tells me to put it back in the cart. I'm never really sure.
Well, and I don't ever want to ask for help in the self-check line. I do not want that person who's standing there at the podium at self-check. Like, if I've got produce that's not on there, I'd rather just enter it as something random that I don't know what it is and go with that than have to degrade myself to have them come down from the podium and be like, oh, I see you've got some zucchini. It's right here. I don't want to have to do that.
That's always like if you're buying a bottle of wine and they have to come do the age thing, that's always, I don't like that.
Yeah. I personally do not feel there is a limit on items in the self-check, because if they wanted there to be a limit,
they should say it.
They would tell you. And I feel as though I can personally scan many more items faster than anyone could in the regular line.
The scanning does not confuse me. It confuses some people. Just find the barcode and scan it.
Just get the barcode.
Now, Adam, can I tell a quick little story that hopefully no police officers are listening to?
Uh-oh.
So I was in the self-check a couple of days ago, and I had some raspberries. Well, the raspberries, Adam, had no barcode on them. Mm. They were supposed to, but I guess it had fallen off somewhere. Mm. So I had to bite the bullet and say, excuse me, sir, working here, I've got some raspberries, but I don't see the barcode. And he goes, just put them in the bag.
Whoa.
Yeah. Watch out. I'm on the run.
But didn't it know that your weight didn't make sense?
He
overrode it?
He overrode the computer saying, now, wait a second. You put something in this bag that you didn't scan.
This feels suspiciously like raspberries.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Wow. So you have like an unspoken agreement. You're like the bank robber who's got a man on the inside.
Yeah, I feel like I just need to like drop a $5 bill on the ground next time I'm in the store so that it'll even out.
Look at that. Mr. Employee, that dollar bill's on the ground. You just pick that up and buy yourself something nice.
Yeah, it felt good to get that off my chest.
I bet. You've been carrying that around for days.
So, all of that upcoming. Adam, I guess we should start with the Clemson game. I don't want to. It was not good. It was a very disappointing performance. I know that, I mean, the Tar Heels feel that way too. But not one thing went right for Carolina in the first 20 minutes of that game. And then the first 8 minutes or so of the second half, they fought back in it, and then nothing went right again. Way too many turnovers, especially in the lower possession, slower-paced game that Clemson wants to play. And struggles at the free throw line in a game where you had to get easy points when they were available because you were struggling so much from the field. It wasn't good.
I thought it was, I guess interesting is the right word, that after the game, Coach Williams, I felt like, really talked more about Carolina's defense than about the offense. I felt like the defensive struggles got outweighed by the glaringness of the offensive issues. Like you just said, Carolina didn't shoot the ball well. They had trouble shooting it because they were turning it over too much. And when they did what he always likes to do, which is get fouled, they went to the free throw line and then missed over half their attempts. So there were definitely some offensive issues, but there were some defensive problems too against a Clemson team that is not world renowned for its offensive prowess. And you're certainly going to play better offensive teams. And I think all those things combined are what made for a long film session for the Tar Heels yesterday when they got back at practice.
Losing is disappointing, always. To me, Adam, this was much more about how Carolina lost than just the fact that it lost. Carolina had been playing well 3 in a row, 6 of 7, as we know, and making progress, it felt like. And then everything that happened on Tuesday night felt a lot like the Tar Heels that played NC State in Raleigh in mid-December, of just the same mistakes that had bothered Carolina early on. And, you know, whether it was the week-long break, who knows why, maybe a young team, you're going to have inconsistencies. I mean, all those things are viable explanations as to why Carolina played poorly. But it just felt like such a punch in the gut after you felt like the Tar Heels had taken some big steps forward as of late.
And Carolina could still beat Duke and Miami, and then we'll say they've won 8 of 10 and things are looking good.
Again, not just the loss is my point.
Right. And it very much, I felt like, did look like, you said the State game, I was thinking the Georgia Tech game, but one of those earlier games. And that makes me wonder if maybe some of it is attributable to rust and having not played at game speed for a week, because that's how the younger Carolina players looked back in December when they weren't playing regular games. And we went back and looked at those 17 turnovers, and I think some of them are rust. Andrew Platek stepping out of bounds. Caleb Love and Leaky Black both turning the ball over, just trying to start their dribble. That's just having not gone against an opposing defense who wants to steal the ball from you for a week. Some of those passes and thinking you can make a pass, and even the ones that weren't turnovers, I'm sure Eric probably talked about this, but some of the passes to the big guys, the amount of times that the big guys had to like move a step either way or reach around to receive the ball, the pass just wasn't there. It wasn't where they want it in order to be most comfortable to start their move. And I do think some of that's rust, but there's no time for rust anymore because things are about to get tough.
Look, Clemson's a good defensive team, but it was a struggle.
Well, Clemson may be a good defensive team, and they were certainly above average on Tuesday, but they had been lit up in the ACC.
Yeah.
I mean, their quote-unquote good defensive numbers were all built out of conference. In conference, facing teams that are more familiar with you, they had not just been getting scored on, they had been getting hammered. And it felt like the Tar Heels, as they have often done this year, let Clemson start to believe they had a chance early, fell behind, 11-2, and you could almost see Clemson going, oh yeah, this is way better than those other games we played recently where we got beat by 20. We got a chance at this. Instead of just taking it to them from the beginning, but Carolina, as we know, just has not been a very good first half team in most cases this year.
So Adam, I think what it does set up is this massive 3 days for Carolina against Duke on Saturday and then Miami on Monday, which, side note, Pod After Dark after the Miami game coming up. These games are enormous now. It would have been an important stretch regardless, because you're playing Duke, and then you're a quick turnaround. You're back at home against a team that on paper you're better than, but Miami certainly is capable. We know that. And Tar Heels had to scratch out a win earlier in the year. Miami's been competitive. You know, they just beat Duke a couple days ago. So it would have been an important stretch, but now I feel like it is a season swinger here coming up. You said this, I think on the video pod yesterday, you know, and we've talked about it some here, Carolina and Duke seem to be lumped together a bunch. Like, oh, both these teams are struggling. I don't think Carolina is struggling as much as Duke has this year. But I also think, and I think you said something similar, all of a sudden the narrative is going to be, especially if Duke wins this game, how much the Tar Heels are struggling. That's what the national narrative is going to be, whether that's fair or not. So you've got Carolina-Duke in and of itself going to be a big game. Both these teams trying to come off disappointing losses. And I think for Carolina, you've got to make sure the Clemson game is one game and doesn't beat you multiple times, or that you don't fall into those habits again, or it's going to be a long last 5 or 6 weeks of the regular season.
I think Saturday is going to be a bloodbath, because I think both teams will be completely desperate. Both coaches will be completely desperate to get their teams to play up to the level that they expect. And I almost think not having fans is going to make it even more intense, because if you had fans, you'd have kind of that feeling of, oh, this isn't a, it doesn't feel like a real Carolina Duke game. This is real for this year. And you got to remember, it's Carolina's third straight road game. And I think if in a normal year, if Carolina had played three straight road games and gone 2-1, which they could if they beat Duke, I think you'd feel okay about that. So you've got a chance to get back to okay. But if you don't, then you start feeling like, well, the Pitt game was the aberration in this series, and that doesn't feel good. And I think Clemson's numbers were not as good as what kind of the general reputation of them was. I think Duke's numbers are better than what the general reputation of them is. Just, they don't seem to quite fit together right, but individually they do some things that are good. And so that, I think that makes you a little bit nervous, because it's not like you're playing Joe Schmo down at the YMCA. I mean, before the year started, they were the hottest thing going. They still got those same guys and the same coach who knows what he's doing. So I think it would be a mistake to think, oh, Carolina will just get right by rolling in there and beating up on Duke, because Duke's not good this year.
Why would anyone think that at any point in time? I mean, I know people do. I'm not suggesting that you're making that up. I just don't feel that. Don't think that way. If you're thinking that way, don't think that way.
Well, I think there are Carolina teams that could have done that.
Right.
We have seen Carolina teams that I would be salivating over the opportunity to go play this Duke team and just absolutely beat them into submission. This Carolina team at this point in the season is not that team. They've got flaws just like Duke's got flaws. And so it's going to be a matter of who conceals their flaws more effectively.
Yeah, I mean, Duke, Matthew Hurt, very good player, good shooter. Jalen Johnson, high talent, has had some really big performances, a little inconsistent, but he's a freshman, not a super big surprise there. Young guards, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, and just at the time of our recording, I haven't gotten deep into my prep for the game. I don't feel like I know a ton about this Duke team outside of what I just said. They've got some talent. They're really young. I think the way that you put it, that it seems like they don't quite fit together, I think it's a good way to put it. The game is winnable, but the Tar Heels also have to look much more like the team that we had been seeing compared to the team that played on Tuesday.
I think it'll be interesting to see what Duke does with Mark Williams, who they've all of a sudden started playing more in that traditional Duke big man role of go out there and set screens and get some offensive rebounds and foul some guys. That's a guy who could be useful against Carolina in that role, because they don't really have that guy. And if they don't play him, I think there's a chance Carolina just demolishes them on the backboards. But he's a guy who's, although he was a very highly rated recruit, seems to be comfortable in that Matt Christensen role, a role model that we all strive to be.
Wow, yeah. One of the Plumleys, probably.
Yeah. One, like a lower tier Plumley.
Yeah.
if they could get him to buy into that, I think he fixes some of their problems, especially against a team like Carolina. I think Jordan Goldwire, you probably tell him before the game, look, you just harass Caleb Love everywhere he goes. You hand check him every time he gets the ball. Put an elbow in him. Whatever you got to do, they're not going to call it every time. Let's see what'll happen. Because that, he's a very good defensive player, and Caleb Love has turned the ball over some. And that's the way you beat Carolina, is by forcing them to turn the ball over. So I think Goldwire and Mark Williams, while not the biggest name players in this game on the Duke side, are two of the more important players.
6 o'clock on Saturday. We'll be on the air at 5. Armando Bacot, Adam, needs to take more than one shot. He had more fouls than rebounds in the game against Clemson. Really odd performance, I thought, because he's been so consistent and good this year. And to not just have like a struggle game, but to almost be a total non-factor, it was a surprise.
Much more like a freshman Bacot than sophomore, which is why I don't think he's going to do that again. I think he's past that. I think that was freshman Armando Bacot. This is sophomore Armando Bacot. I think he plays much better, and Carolina needs for him too, obviously.
Yeah. Also be interested to see how De'Ron Sharp does at the free throw line, and I know that's kind of a minuscule point to make, but it was clear, I think, at one point in that Clemson game, it was in his head what was happening at the line. And he sat right here and talked to us that he's worked hard on it, felt like he had improved on it. And then he did make, I think, his last three and four out of his last five, because that is important for how Carolina wants to be successful. They've got to have Brooks and Bacot and Sharp be able to make free throws at least at a 70-ish percent clip to take advantage of some of the advantage that they have with the size.
Because otherwise teams are just going to foul you.
Right. They're just going to foul you, and they're happy to get out of there with you missing two free throws or getting 1 point out of it compared to the other option.
You'd rather foul them and take a chance. Your chances are higher at De'Ron Sharp missing a free throw than your chances are of blocking a shot.
Yeah.
That's probably not going to happen.
Adam, what else you got for Carolina Duke on Saturday? And then the quick turnaround to Miami. I mean, to your point, the amount of energy that is going to be poured into this game, deservedly so, then you've got to make a quick turnaround if you're the Tar Heels to get ready to see a Miami team that, again, is not had a terrific year, but is certainly good enough to win the game and does things that gives Carolina trouble at times with their ability to penetrate, and they have not shot the three well this year, but they hit some big ones in the victory against Duke on Monday night. So they've got a great player in Isaiah Wong at the guard spot that Carolina was able to hold down. And they also play on Saturday. It is earlier in the day. They play at noon against Virginia Tech at home, and then, of course, have to travel, but so we'll see. They've been better at home than on the road, too, which I think is a fair statement for almost every team in the league this year.
And Carolina's better at home than on the road.
Yeah.
So that favors Carolina. The Saturday Mondays, I think, has been well documented, are always tougher when you travel on the Monday. So Carolina doesn't have to do that, and they don't really even have to travel far on Saturday. So I think that makes it slightly easier. But I think any other teams don't understand this, but when you – anytime you involve the Carolina-Duke game, that's really like two games. So you're really playing two games Saturday with the amount of just mental effort that's going into that game. Then to get it back together and play Monday, and there have been times this year that Miami's looked really good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been such a weird year. They kicked Matt Cross off the team, who it looked like was going to be pretty good, I thought.
Right.
Now he's gone. He made some threes against Carolina and Coral Gables. Chris Likes is just sitting there in a sweatsuit, and no one knows what's happening with him. Cameron McGusty comes and goes.
Yeah, it's been a weird year.
But they're always right there. Like, whenever you see them actually play on the floor, you think they've got a chance to be pretty good. And they're going to drive the ball right at Carolina every single time. So if you don't stop the ball well, or if they get hot from three, then they're perfectly capable of winning that game.
I will also be interested to see on Saturday if Duke plays zone, because they played a lot of zone against Miami. They have started to play more zone here recently. Miami came in to that game as the worst three-point shooting team in the league percentage-wise. I think strategy-wise, it's not a terrible idea. But Miami was also able to carve that zone up at times and get some easy baskets. And so I'd be interested to see how much, if any, zone Duke plays against Carolina.
And it seemed like Duke went to that because they couldn't stop Miami's dribble penetration. I think you'd almost want a different kind of zone against Carolina because you'd be worried about other things.
Mm-hmm.
But it does certainly seem like they're headed down the path of zone that we've seen them take a time or two in the past.
So, big stretch here coming up, without a doubt, for this season. Saturday, Monday.
We'll know much more how we feel about the next month by the time we do the next pod than we do right now.
Carolina Insider presented by Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, reminding you to practice your 3 W's, wear, weight, wash. We resolved to keep North Carolina healthy. Now, we got a tweet that said we didn't wear, weight, wash. I don't think that's right. We did wear, weight, wash.
I thought we did, but goodness sakes, I've been wrong before, and I don't want to run the risk this time.
I'm fine rebooting the wear, weight, wash for this stretch.
Yeah, it was Cameron who said he doesn't think we specified which W Clemson was. So, hey, our bad.
I think we did, but I'm willing to reboot the wear, weight, wash for the good of the program.
Yeah, for the team, let's make it clear. Duke is the wear.
Yeah.
Miami's the weight.
Yep.
And we know Miami's comfortable being in this wear, weight, wash because they were the original wear.
Yeah.
So this time they're going to be weight. Duke's going to be wear. And if we're fortunate enough to stay around and play again, we'll worry about the wash then.
It's Virginia.
Mm. We'll worry about that then.
What a mess of a season this has become. I'm not talking about for Carolina. I'm talking about in the AC. Like, who's good? I thought Virginia Tech was good. And then they lost to Pitt, who I thought was good earlier and then wasn't good. And now got a big win. Virginia has been going okay. They lost to Virginia Tech. Didn't look great against State, who's playing without Devin Daniels, but won the game, most importantly for them. Florida State's not playing anymore right now. Like, what's happening?
I think one thing I've learned this year is that it's harder to figure out who's good when everyone doesn't play all their games all the time.
Yeah.
That makes it more difficult to tell. And you're never quite sure, like, if a team plays poorly, are they playing poorly because they just hadn't played for 2 weeks, or is it because they're not good? It's hard to tell.
Notre Dame was really bad earlier in the year. Now they're winning a bunch of games. Louisville, who I don't even think about, they won. They beat Georgia Tech, who I thought maybe was getting their groove back after beating Florida State. Just everybody's – well, we said this at the very beginning of the year. I don't think there's a great team. I don't think there's a terrible team. I think everybody is in a big old pot together. And it's, who am I going to ladle out tonight? Oh, look, it's the Tar Heels. Got Georgia Tech tonight. It's just, you never know.
I think there was a little bit of a race to tell me that Virginia was great. And they really haven't played anybody. They played Virginia Tech and lost to them. They played NC State earlier this week, and they beat them. They looked okay. But that's not Kyle Guy out there. Mm-mm. That's not DeAndre Hunter.
Mama D. Diakite is not walking through that door, Adam. By the way, now, I know this is going to sound like sour grapes. We've talked a lot about the benches this year.
Mm.
I think, Adam, when we see the Virginia bench in person, it may send us over there. I could hear them chanting defense during the game against State like it was a middle school game.
Well, and they were like prancing around their bench area. I'm sure you're talking about during the State game, same way I am.
Yeah.
It was distracting how many antics were going on over there.
Yes.
And Tony Bennett is Mr. No Antics guy.
Yeah.
But their bench was, there was so much happening.
Don't chant defense. I don't think you can do that, Adam.
Well, you can, but you have to accept that the other third-grade rec team is going to be upset at you.
Right. I don't think as a college team you can chant defense on the bench.
Central did that a couple of possessions against the Tar Heels.
Don't you talk bad about Lavelle Moten. We respect him.
Well, I think...
Yeah, that's Central.
All credit to Lavelle Moten, but that's a different type of team than Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of their place in college basketball right now, currently. It definitely... I'll be interested to see how I feel about them in person. I'm sure I'll respect them.
I already know how I'm going to feel, and I don't even want that. Present day Jones already knows what future Jones is going to feel.
I would really like to know. I think it's true, but I don't know that it's true. I think some coaches have told their benches to dial it up.
Oh, absolutely.
That there's no energy in there. We need you guys who, look, you're not going to get out on the court and play, but here's how you help this team win. You just act a fool over there and try to pump our guys up.
Well, I'm trying to remember where it was, Adam, that we went earlier in the year. Actually, you know what? I think it's Virginia. It's Virginia football that they call themselves like the fourth side. They call their sideline the fourth side. So there's offense, defense, special teams, and then how you act on the sideline.
Is that what Thomas Jefferson called it? When he was on the grounds?
Yeah. See, Adam, I don't even know how you got me into this mindset, but you got me here.
Wear weight wash.
Yeah. Okay. Whew. Okay. We're going to need to go to this Kevin Salvadori interview before I say something I'm going to regret that I don't edit out. I am going to go ahead and tell you this was a really good interview with Kevin Salvadori. So Kevin Salvadori, as he's going to correct me in saying, in my mind, he was part of the Eric Montross class, but he was actually a year earlier than that, redshirted his freshman year, and then was a senior the same year that Eric and Derek Phelps and those guys were in 1994. A member of the 93 championship team, played a bunch. He was one of the first guys off the bench on that team, started some games, I think, that year also for Carolina. So we talk about 93, we talk about 94, and when things didn't go as well, we talk about Coach Smith. We talk about his Toyota Supra. We talk about not Coach Smith's Toyota Supra, Kevin Salvadori's. We talk about Family Feud, all kinds of stuff.
Some really good Jim Valvano information in here.
Yeah.
Made me wonder what if with NC State.
Oh, yeah.
Because just listen to the way he talks about Jim Valvano and imagine that turning into something longer term. But part of what made Jim Valvano Jim Valvano is what brought it down. But if they just don't make him athletic director. But I think they did that to keep him there. We'll have a whole pod on the Jim Valvano era coming up soon.
Man, now I know you're ready to listen to Kevin Salvadori. So let's get to that. We're going to transition from that right to Marcus Page. Marcus was our guest on the video pod yesterday. If you didn't see that, you're going to hear me ask him a question at the end about his injury. He's got a big gash on his face. So that's what I'm talking about when I ask if he's hurt. You obviously can't see it on this because this is an audio-only podcast.
Unless you're on the gold feed.
Right. I know it gets confusing with the amount of information that we give to you, but this is audio-only. Okay. Kevin Salvadori, Marcus Page, then we're back with more after this on the Carolina Insider.
We've got another national champion with us today, but not just any national champion. He's a member of one of our very favorite teams, the 1993 national champions. Kevin Salvadori, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you giving us some time today.
Glad to be here. Always, like I said earlier, always good to talk to some people about Carolina basketball.
How often does somebody like see your name or see you and be like, wait a minute, were you on that 93 Carolina team?
It doesn't happen that much. About 3 years ago, I moved to Atlanta. When I was in Charlotte, living up in Charlotte, it happened all the time. But down here in Atlanta, I'm just another guy. So, and that's okay. And listen, man, I'm old now. That stuff happened a long time ago. I just can't believe I'm remembered at all. And every once in a while, I still get a basketball card in the mail for somebody that wants me to sign it, which I think is crazy.
So, Kevin, catch us up on what you're doing now. What's going on in your life down in Atlanta?
You know, I've been bouncing around all kinds of different things, but the last year with crazy COVID and everything, I started up my own business. It didn't do well after COVID, so I closed that down. I got into back into pharmaceutical sales with a company called Jazz Pharmaceuticals, and it's been fantastic.
How that had to be frustrating. Take a step forward, try something on your own with a small business, and have all this happen that didn't give you much of a chance. What was that like?
Incredibly frustrating. And, you know, I mean, listen, you play Carolina, you're competitive. And I felt like that was a loss, and I don't take losses very well. And I probably hung on longer than what I should have because I refused to accept failure. But I got to tell you, I landed well on my feet with the company I'm with now. So it ended up working out pretty well in the long run. But at first, I was not a happy person.
Not too many losses as a Tar Heel. What's it like to have Dean Smith come into your living room, be recruited by North Carolina? And for those who don't know, Kevin was from Pittsburgh, an area that produced several Tar Heels in that era.
It was kind of funny because the first time Coach Smith came was to my high school, and I'll never forget because we had coaches come to my high school quite often. They'd just come unannounced and they would just pop in, and I'd be pulled out of class and I would go somewhere and I'd talk to the coach. And we went into the gym to talk for the first time, and it was funny because we had those long, narrow windows on the gym door, and we were sitting there talking. I obviously enjoyed talking to Coach Smith a lot because I ended up going to Carolina, but I'll never forget looking over at those doors while we were talking, and there wasn't a space open on those doors because all my friends and other people in the school were just looking in. They couldn't believe Coach Smith was there. But the thing I remember, well, two things I remember most about Coach Smith when he came and recruited me was just how genuine he was, how down to earth and genuine it made me feel important, made me feel just at ease. And the other thing that was amazing was he recruited my dad way back when he first started at Carolina, and my dad ended up going to South Carolina. And one of the things he asked me was if my grandmother was still making her homemade bread. My grandparents are from Italy. And you know, that happened 30 years prior. And the fact that he still remembered my grandmom's homemade bread, you know, you hear stories about like that with Coach Smith and what he remembers. But that was my first experience with that, and I thought that was kind of crazy.
Kevin, do you still have the check that Coach Smith sent to all the former players? Did you keep it? Did you spend it? How did you handle that?
Well, what I did was I did both. I was able to take a picture of it and enter it into my account by depositing it through my cell phone. Because I, you know, Coach Smith wanted me to take my family out to dinner, and I wanted to I wanted to make sure I did what he asked. So it was one of the last things he's ever asked of me. And so I took the family out for dinner. We had a phenomenal dinner that night, and I thought a lot about, and that's exactly what he asked, and it was impossible not to. I thought about a lot of the times we had together as a team with the coaches and the players and the managers at those phenomenal dinners. And then on top of that, because I was able to just take a picture of the check, I still have it. So I got the best of both worlds.
That's a veteran move.
Yeah, that's right. Just get all the bases covered.
Hey, listen, you got to think outside the box and figure out how you can get everything you can get.
What was your experience like just culturally moving to Chapel Hill, being a part of Carolina basketball at that time in the early 90s?
Well, you got to remember, my visit to North Carolina was late. It was late. It was early spring. They started recruiting me late. I was going to NC State. I love Coach Valvano. He recruited me since my junior year. That's where I was going. Coach Smith came in late. And so I go down to my visit, and I leave Pittsburgh, and it's snowing. Just flurries, but it's snowing. It's that cold. I get to Chapel Hill, and it's 85 degrees, and, you know, you're walking across campus, and it's gorgeous out, and there's co-eds laying out, and it's just – it's springtime, and it's – I'm like, this is a different world. It's ridiculous. But and we had a big recruiting class that came in, and we all got along so well. They're just great guys. And just automatically integrated. And the thing that drew me to Chapel Hill more than any other school, which I saw anywhere else, and you hear about all the time, oh, family, 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 family. They lived it. And I saw it on my visit. And the second I stepped on campus, I was accepted by the players, the coaches, everybody involved with the organization, the basketball organization. And it was just, I'll never forget, my mom was, when they dropped me off, she didn't want to leave. I was the youngest. I was a baby. She didn't want me to leave. She didn't want to leave because she was leaving her baby behind. I couldn't wait for them to go. I love my parents, but I couldn't wait for them to go. Like, just being enveloped in that organization, the basketball organization, was just the most incredible thing that I've probably still to this day have ever had.
That recruiting class is such a well-known one in Carolina basketball history. Of course, Eric Montrose, part of that class, and Derek Phelps and others.
I got to correct you on that. You got to remember, I redshirted.
Oh, that's right.
So I came in with George Lynch, Matt Wenstrom, Henrik Rödl, Kenny Harris, and Scott Cherry. So it's still a big class, but I redshirted and I ended up graduating with Eric and Brian and Derek. And Pat ended up redshirting later on as well. So
that's right. Those were two back-to-back really big recruiting classes that, of course, ended up being the cornerstones of so many great teams for Carolina in the 90s. What was the relationship like with all those guys?
It's phenomenal. And one of the most flattering things I will have with me for the rest of my life, Coach Smith always talked about recruiting a person on top of a basketball player. And for him to include me in that, to view me as that type of person, and he wanted to be a part of that program, it really means a lot to me. It really does. And it will forever. And those guys, the group that I came in initially with and the guys that I ended up graduating with, all fit that mold. They're just great people, great people. We don't stay in touch as much as we used to. Everybody's got families, we've got jobs, we're all over the country, and some of us across the world. But, it's amazing when we get together. And when we got together a couple of years ago, we had everybody there for the 25th anniversary celebration for the national championship. It was like a day didn't go by. I hadn't seen Henrik Rödl in 20 years. And we hung out for a long time. Everybody. And it was like a day didn't go by. We didn't miss a beat. We just slipped right back into those old relationships and just had a great, great, great time. Those are brothers. That's family that I will have for the rest of my life, and I am very grateful to be a part of it.
I don't know that we've talked to anyone who's had this experience. What were some of the differences and similarities in being recruited by Jim Valvano and being recruited by Dean Smith?
Totally different. I mean, you can't talk about two totally different personalities. I have never met to this day anybody as dynamic as Coach Valvano. I love Coach Valvano. And I'm Salvadori, Valvano, he had Corciani, Gugliotta. He talked about starting the Mafia South. And he was just, he came to my house and, coach comes in for an hour, maybe a little bit longer than an hour, maybe 2 hours at the most. We were 3 hours into his home visit. He's down on one knee in front of the coffee table, has all this stuff spread out. And finally I turned to coach and I said, listen, I'm starving. I got to get something to eat. And we took him to a pizza place right up the street. I went there probably twice a week. They knew me so well. And we brought Coach Valvano in there. And within 10 minutes, the whole restaurant was surrounding our table. And that's who he was. He was just a dynamic personality. And I will say this, when I decided to go to Chapel Hill, I called, there was a handful of coaches still in the mix. And I saved Coach Valvano's last because I really hated telling him that I wasn't going to go there. I got yelled at, I got cursed at, I got hung up on. And, those things just, hey, that just reinforces what I already knew, that wasn't the place for me. And I'll never forget, Coach Valvano was upset. He was disappointed. But he said, listen, is there anything I could ever do for you in the future? Let me know. Love meeting you, love getting to know you, love getting to know your family. And every time we saw him 1 year when he was a state still, when I was a redshirt freshman, he checked on me every time. When he was at ESPN calling games, he checked on me every game, always spent time with my family. He was just a genuinely really good guy, very dynamic guy. Coach Smith didn't have that outgoing, crazy personality that Coach Valvano did. He was much more reserved, obviously, but just both of them, I think, were just high quality people. Coach Smith is, to this day, and I probably to the day I die, was the smartest person I've ever been around. And I don't think I could have ever played for anybody that could have taken better care of me when I'm, growing up and becoming an adult. And it was the best decision I ever made. And, you go back and you go back and look at your life, and there's a ton of decisions I wish I could change. And the one I would never, ever, ever change would be my decision to go to Chapel Hill.
Kevin, what was it about Dean Smith that made him different? What was it that made him on a different level than other coaches?
What aspect are you talking about? Because there's a lot of aspects. I could go on for a long time. On the court, he's the smartest person I ever saw. He never forgot things. I remember we were playing in the NCAA tournament and for the national championship, leading up to the national championship, and we were playing, I think it was Cincinnati or Temple. I can't remember. This shows you right there. I don't have the memory he does. But I remember I was on the floor, and we got to stop and call a timeout. And you know, they put Eric Montross in for the offensive side, and I was in there for the defensive side. And we sat down, and we get in the huddle, and Coach Smith's just kind of looking around. He's got a smile on his face. And we're like, we got a couple, you know, got less than a minute left to go, and if we score, game's over. And he goes, yeah, and then back in 1972, we played this team, and blah, blah, blah. He ran off all five starter players. And we're looking around like, what the heck is he talking about? And he goes, and then they play this exact same defense. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this. We're going to run the clock down. It was like he read the script. And we break the timeout, and we look at each other on the bench, and we go, 1972? I was 2 years old. How the heck do you remember that? And when we got into the play, and we did exactly what he told us to do, exactly what he told us to do, worked exactly as he said it was going to work. And it was, we were so stunned on the sideline for 5-10 seconds. We just looked at each other like, that was crazy. And that was the genius he brought to the game on the court. But off the court, you know, and practices and things like that, he asked a lot from us. And he, practices were 10 times harder than any game we ever played. And he worked our butts off, but he gave us everything he could, everything legally the NCAA would allow him to give us. He gave us everything he could and was allowed to give us, treated us with the utmost respect. He demanded it back. And he was better to me after I graduated. When I went to the NBA, played for a couple of years, there's players I talked to that, you know, they were like, you know, what are you going to do in the offseason? I'm going to go back to Chapel Hill. You're going to go back to, you know, one of them was Syracuse. You're going to go back to Syracuse. He was like, no, it's crazy. Why would I ever go back there? They're done with me. They want nothing left to do with me. And Coach Smith loved for us to come back. He wanted to see us. He wanted to spend time with us. And if there was anything he could ever do for us, he did it because there was no more, you know, regulations put on him. And he was more genuinely giving after we left because he could be. And I don't know many coaches that would ever do that.
On this day in 1992, the Tar Heels hosted at the Smith Center an undefeated Duke team that had won the national title the year before. They were the hottest thing going in college basketball, and a strapping center named Kevin Salvadori put up 12 points and 6 boards against them. Carolina won the game. First of all, can you just put into context to us what the feeling was about Duke at that point in 1992?
Listen, they were the number one team in the country. They just won the national championship, and they knew it. They knew it. They did. They were like, we are the best thing that's ever happened. They were arrogant. There was a player on the other team, not to be named, that I really, really, really just did not like. And that just added to my motivation. And I don't like arrogance. I just don't like it. And we went out there, and we just wanted to knock that chip off their shoulder. And that was the lead up of us. You know, you talked about 93 championship team being one of your favorites. Listen, that was one of the toughest teams I think Carolina's ever seen. It was by far the toughest mentally and physically team that I've ever been on. And I think that was the start of it, was that 92 year. You know, George Lynch was starting to assert himself a little bit more. Eric was as well. I was coming into my own. And we wanted to show people, and listen, we were number, I think, 9 in the country, I believe, I think. And I mean, we weren't any dogs out there, but we definitely wanted to let them know that they weren't any better than us. That's for damn sure.
What about George Lynch made him so good in the role that he eventually took on those teams? We got a chance a couple, gosh, Adam, what, 2 years ago now, when Carolina was playing down in Atlanta, to go and talk with George for a while. What was it that made him so good in that veteran leader role?
George is a guy that just, he gave everything he had to give physically and mentally on the floor. There's nobody that ever played harder than him on that floor, on either team when he was on that floor. He just played so damn hard. And he asked that from you just to say just as much. But he knew what he just had it. There's an inherent ability to lead some people have. I wish I had it like George did. I don't. I don't know anybody else that I've ever played with that had that inherent ability to lead other people. I would have ran through a damn wall for George. He had a way of knowing when to kick you in the butt, when to pick you up. And just, he was always there just doing what he demanded others to do. And he just had a way of about him that you wanted to be around him and you wanted to follow him. And you sure as hell didn't want to let him down because he was just that guy that was going to give you everything that he had. And it's hard. Listen, I've never been around a leader like George. George is a great friend, best teammate I've ever had. Every year that I was on the team with George, he was that MVP on that team. He just was. He was that type of person. It's so hard to put into words how George was for that team. But, I mean, Donald had a great Final Four, no question about it. He deserved MOP on that. But without George, there's no way we are where we are where we were on that national championship in the year before. I mean, from freshman year on, you go back and watch a game of George played, and the second he got on the floor – he made things out. He didn't even know what the hell he was doing as a freshman. We used to laugh at him and joke about him. He would run around to be in a completely wrong position. But then he hustled so hard, he'd get back into the right position to make a play. And Coach Smith used to get so frustrated with him. But then after a while, it was just like, hey, let him go. Because he just was always working so damn hard. And then as he learned the system, as he learned to play the game even better, he just became dynamic. He was, I can't say enough about how I felt about George having him as a teammate and still having him as a friend. So, he was just phenomenal.
Now, when we have a guest on the Carolina Insider, we make sure to do extensive research into their background and history in Chapel Hill. So we have a couple things to ask you about. Number one would be, what can you tell us about your, what we have heard termed, badass Supra?
Oh, my God, where did that come from? Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, the funny thing was that goes back to my visit. Somebody that Rick Fox and King Rice knew who were taking me around on my visit, they had a Supra. And I was like, oh, this is a nice car. And the crazy thing was, it's a little sports car. And I remember getting ready to get in the front seat. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to fold my butt up into this car and fit. There's no way. And I got in the car and I stretched my legs out and I went, wait, what the heck is this? And so, you know, my parents made a deal with me and my two brothers. If we got a scholarship, any kind of scholarship whatsoever, they would buy us a car. Used car, but they'd buy us a car and we could, you know, pick out whatever we wanted. And I said, you know what? I love that Supra. I had more leg room in that thing than I could ever imagine. And my parents got me that Supra. And the crazy thing was, it was about a 7.5-hour drive back and forth from Chapel Hill to Pittsburgh. And it was, I had the stick, I had the, you know, the clutch to work with. But once I got on the highway, I could literally stretch my legs all the way out and lock my knees in that car. And I have never been able to do that with another car since. So I love that, man. That thing could zip around, and that thing had a lot of leg room. And it was so funny because I was getting out of it. I had to, like, it looked like I was folding myself out of the car. But I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Those Atlanta car dealers are getting ready to get some calls looking for some 1992 Toyota Supras. Now, another thing that we uncovered is that apparently you could consume a very impressive quantity of food. So what was your go-to Chapel Hill restaurant and what was the standard Kevin Salvadori order?
I kind of figured out later on that I ate about 10,000 calories a day because I was always so skinny. And I was trying to put on weight, and probably in the long run, probably hurt me because, you know, nowadays they say if you want to increase your metabolism, eat like 4 or 5 meals a day, small meals a day. I was eating 4 or 5 large meals a day. And we'd go on the road and I'd have a 3-pound porterhouse with sides and appetizers and all kind of crazy stuff. But it was just funny because yesterday I was cleaning up one of my cabinets and I came across the old Rathskeller glass that I had. I love the Rat. I used to go down the Rat all the time. And people, they used to have the single and double gambler. And I don't even think it was on the menu. But they had a triple gambler. And I'd go down there and I'd get the triple gambler, fries, salad. And I used to love it when they got fancy at the end. But they had that apple pie on a tin plate with a square piece of ice cream on top of it. And I would go down there and I would just sit at the bar. I got to know the owner and the bartender. Would sit at the bar and order my triple gambler and my sides and everything else and walk out of there a pretty happy person.
Triple gambler. That's big time.
Triple gambler. I don't even think it was on the menu, but listen, I remember eating a double, and I'm like, man, I'm still hungry. So they're like, it's time to order a triple. I was like, all right. And I did every time ever since then. Listen, I could eat, and people were like, oh, I'm so jealous. It became a chore. And actually, after a while, you just got sick of eating. It was just gross. I'm glad that I eat almost like a normal human being now.
All right, take us back to New Orleans and Carolina, Michigan, national championship game. What are your memories? What do you think about when you look back at that game?
I tell you what, that the game itself against Michigan was very much almost like a blur. They were good. People remember we played them in Hawaii earlier that year, and they hit us on a buzzer beater lucky shot. And they talked so much trash in that game. And we were hoping to see them again. And when we saw them again, it was funny because they didn't say much. They didn't talk as much as they did the first time. Because every time they talked trash in that first game, listen, we were tough. We didn't put up with any of that garbage. We went right back at them. And there's certain snippets of that game that I remember, but a lot of it's a blur. Even more of a blur was the celebration afterwards on the court and in the locker room, the excitement, and just it was overwhelming. It really, really was overwhelming. And when we first started the game, one of the first things I remember was the excitement level, the adrenaline level was so high. I mean, you'd be on the floor for a minute and a half, and you're putting your fist up because you were winded, you were worn out, you were exhausted because you were just so excited and so fired up to play that game. And then once you sat down and came back in the game, you were fine. But I just remember us playing so well together as a team. And I mean, one of the things George said at the beginning of the year, we're winning this for Coach Smith. Coach Smith has won national championship, and that's a travesty. That's just a joke. And our battle cry the whole year is win one for Coach Smith. And I couldn't have been happier to be part of a team that was able to do that for Coach Smith. And just to be a part of it with those guys was just phenomenal. But you know, Michigan was good. Chris Webber was ridiculous. He was unfair to play against on that floor, I'll tell you that much. But you know, everybody thought we were going to go out there and get our butts beat. And we knew there wasn't a chance in heck we were going to like lay down for them and just roll over and let them beat us. We went out there and we were ready to fight. And I don't think two things. They weren't nearly as well coached and they weren't nearly as close of a team. And I think those are the two things that why we won the game was we were the closest. That was the closest group of people I've ever been with. You know, we had the best coach in the country. And I mean, we were killed for each other. And we did that on the floor every time.
We had the chance during quarantine. Jones and I just kind of randomly ended up watching some older games, and we watched a lot of 1993 games. And I think because on paper, maybe that team doesn't look as formidable as, say, Michigan that year or whatever, people don't understand how good they were. When you really watched that 93 team play, that was a great team.
It really wasn't a thing. And what's so funny is even Carolina fans forget about – a lot of Carolina fans forget about that team. Which is, I think, it's a travesty. I mean, we were good. I didn't realize this until so many years ago. We were talking to Coach Ford. We were the best rated defense Carolina has ever had, at least up until, about 10 years ago. I don't know if that's changed at all, but our statistical numbers defensively was the best defensive team that Carolina ever had. And you know, I took a lot of pride in that because we just did. I remember, I mean, we would watch film, and there was never a fear of, you know, as a big man, especially, you're supposed to, you know, you feel like you're supposed to sit back, and I'm a shot blocker too. You're supposed to sit back and protect that rim. But my assignment was when the ball moved over, I had to run out and maybe sometimes guard the wing or have to go over here. And there was never a fear of, is somebody going to fill in my spot? Because we just played so well together. We just knew exactly what we had to do, knew exactly where we had to be. And listen, we didn't have James Worthy, we didn't have Michael Jordan, we didn't have John Hansborough, we didn't have all these big names on that team. We got two guys with their jerseys up in the roster, and deservedly so. But we were a lunch pail team. We were going to go out there and we're going to knock you in your face, and we're going to outwork you. We're going to be fundamentally better than you, and you're just going to we're going to wear you down, and we're going to beat you. And there was not one game ever that I remember going out there and going, oh man, this team's really good. I hope we can be okay. Because it was, if we do what we have to do, we will win this game. And the games that we lost, we can look back and go, you know what? We didn't do this. We didn't do that. And that's why we lost. Not because they were better than us, but because we didn't do what we were supposed to do.
What were some of the challenges the next year when you're the defending national champions? Here comes this class of McInnis, Stackhouse, and Wallace, who obviously are very talented, but also everyone has very high opinions of them. As you're trying to mix all that together, what were some of the challenges that team faced?
There's a lot of challenges. And I think I know for myself, I didn't put the effort in the offseason. I worked hard in the offseason, but I didn't put the effort in like I normally did. So I came into the season not as prepared as I did the previous couple of years. So that was a big letdown on myself. And, being 50 now, you can look back at that and go, ah, that was stupid. But the problem was like, we had guys on the team the year before, and I was one of them that, listen, we have a chance to do something great here. I don't need to play as much. I can take a step back. We had a couple of people that did that. And then my senior year, I'm like, this is my senior year. I'm not stepping back. There's a couple other people that didn't want to step back. The guys that were there that were freshman year, we won the national championship. Now all of a sudden, they're good enough to play. We had so much time. We had so much more talent in 93-94 team than the 92-93 team. And that was the biggest problem. That was by far the biggest problem. We never built team chemistry. We missed George. We lost our leader. We had people trying to step up, but it's hard to replace somebody like George. We had too much talent. And listen, Rasheed and Stack and Jeff came in. Man, they were good, especially Sheed. I mean, I remember the first time we played pickup against Rasheed, I'm like, wait a minute, this guy's a freshman? How the heck is this guy a freshman? I mean, he was just so good. And, I mean, you saw the career he had at Carolina in the NBA. I mean, he was just phenomenal. We didn't have enough basketballs to go around. We just didn't. And that was the hardest part. We never built that team chemistry. And we were by far the most talented team in the country, but we didn't play well together. And, when you lose Derek Phelps, it was just – a staple at the point guard for years with us. That's hard to overcome. And Jeff was still learning the system. It's not a knock on Jeff. It's tough as a freshman to step in, especially in tournament time. When Derek was by far, he was an extension of Coach Smith on the floor. He was by far the smartest player I played with. And that hurt. That hurt a lot. But chemistry was the number one problem we had that year.
Kevin, Adam and I are big game show fans. And we recently learned that there was a Kevin Salvadori appearance on Family Feud. We need the full breakdown of what it's like to be a Family Feud participant.
Well, let's take a step back. My mom is a diehard Family Feud fan. She loves Steve Harvey. So my brother, they used to film here in Atlanta. And I was living up in Charlotte at the time. My brother was living in Atlanta. And my brother's like, hey, we could try out here in Atlanta. And we were thinking my mom's going to be on the show, and she checked it out. She said, nope, I'm not going to go on TV. She wouldn't do it, but we're like, all right, we'll do it for her. So it was me, maybe Family Feud's the right name, because it was me, now my ex-wife, my brother, now his ex-wife, and niece all went on there for Family Feud for my mom. And I mean, it was a lot of fun. Steve Harvey was phenomenal. He was very entertaining. And what was great about him, you take a 5-minute commercial break, and instead of him going out in the back and, taking a break or whatever, he'd do stand-up for the crowd. And it was a lot of fun. The problem was, we talked about this earlier, I don't handle losing very well. And we lost. And I thought, we had a lot of really good answers. And we went into the last answer to maybe take it to sudden death. And we had the best answer. And we're going to keep on going. And it wasn't up there. So me and my competitive spirit, it took me a couple of weeks to get over losing that stupid game. But it was a lot of fun. And then we did it for my mom. She got a chance. She still has it. I mean, heck, that was, 5-6 years ago maybe now, maybe even a little longer. She still has on her cell phone the background picture on there is a picture of her and Steve Harvey. And that's exactly why we did it. So It was fun. It was a great experience. We lost. I didn't take that very well.
What's more nerve-wracking, going to the free throw line at a sold-out Smith Center in front of 21,000 fans and everybody's looking at you, or going to the face-off with Steve Harvey standing there and he says, we surveyed 100 people and you got to think and hit the button?
You know what? You're talking to the wrong person. I don't get nervous. You used to drive my ex-wife nuts because I just, like, whatever's going on, I don't get nervous. And I think that's why I did well with basketball, and I think Coach Smith made that even more less of an issue because, hey, you do preparation, and, you know, what happens, happens. You can't do anything else. And, I mean, you can't really prepare for Family Feud, but I walked up there, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to beat this guy's butt. I'm quicker than him. And, I mean, I was never like, oh, my God, this is scary, because there's a bunch of people in the crowd. You can't hear Steve Harvey's right there. It was fun. It was absolutely just fun. And the thing I miss more than anything, when I walk into a stadium and hear the crowd cheering, and whether it be booing or cheering, I mean, I used to love that. I used to love walking up to the free throw line and people cheering against you, screaming at you to miss, because that just makes you concentrate more. And those are the things I miss a lot of. I miss the crowds, I miss the teammates, I miss the camaraderie of the game.
Now, you mentioned you played in the NBA. You played 2 years with the Sacramento Kings. You also mentioned your feelings about Duke. Bobby Hurley was on those teams. What was that like to share a locker room with Bobby Hurley?
Well, let's take a quick step back. When Bobby played at Duke, I felt like he whined a lot. I thought he cried a lot. And we talked about, you know, our point guards, be physical with Bobby. He doesn't handle the physicality of it a lot. So I used to yell at him a lot on the court when he was whining. We'd be going up and down the court, and I'd be, listen, I can't repeat it on the radio, but I used to call him for name. So, you know, I'm going to Sacramento, and I walk in the locker room, and there's one person in the whole damn locker room, and it's Bobby. And he looks up, and he's like, hey, Kevin. I'm like, hey, Bobby, what's going on? How you doing? It was just like, oh, man, seriously? Well, we got to court, and, you know, Bobby's a very smart player. He's a great player at Duke. And, I mean, there's a lot of guys at Grant Hill and Cherokee Parks and Tony Lang and later on Bobby. You know, we became really good friends, good guys, just good people. And Bobby and I, once we got on the court, we realized that, you know, we were both coached by brilliant coaches and just knew the game, and we played very, very well together. We became very good friends. Bobby's a great guy. We really became really good friends. But I tell you what, I can't remember many more awkward moments than when I walked in that locker room and there was just one person in the locker room. And you could tell he had the same feeling I did. But became good friends with him. Bobby's a great guy. He's been successful. I'm very happy for him.
All right, Kevin, before we let you go, I'd just be interested now. You know, you said you're 50 years old. You've been away from Carolina for a while. But when you look back, when you think about what Carolina basketball has meant for you, what kind of feelings does that bring up for you?
There's not a bad feeling I have when I think about Carolina. The school itself was phenomenal. And you know, I went to Carolina because it had everything. It just wasn't a coach. It wasn't just players. It wasn't the facilities. Carolina had everything. I loved going to school there. I loved the people I went to school with. I love running. There's a huge Carolina alumni faction down here in Atlanta. And I run into people here. There's never anybody I've ever run into that said, you know what? I didn't like going to school there. It was an amazing experience just to go to school at Chapel Hill. And then you could just jack that up by 100, put it on steroids, whatever you want to say, by playing basketball there. And the friends and the family and the experiences and the places we went. I mean, I could go on for an hour about everything that was just so phenomenal about what I did. I sat down, you know, with my dad. He still lives in Pittsburgh. And I sat down with him probably about a year ago. And he sort of reminisced. He goes, you know what? You took us on one hell of a ride. When you went to Chapel Hill, I said, yeah, it was fantastic. And we just started reminiscing. And I mean, listen, once you start going down that road, it's hard to stop because there's just so much. There's just so much that was just phenomenal. It just, I was very fortunate, very lucky. It was kind of an odd way that they found me. I'm glad they did. I was one of very few people that got an opportunity to go to Chapel Hill, play for Coach Smith, and play with the teammates I did. And there's not one regret. There's not one bad feeling, not one bad thing I could ever say about going to Chapel and playing basketball there.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
one of the all-time Roy Williams team members, Marcus Page, here with us. Marcus, tell us where in the world you are. We're talking to you after a big victory, and catch us up on how things have been going.
Yeah, so I'm in Belgrade, Serbia. This is my third season with Partizan. Played a couple of years in the G League, and now, yeah, this is my third year. And, yeah, we just won a big Europe game. We played two competitions, one regionally and then one all across Europe. We're actually in the same group as Luke May, so I got to see him a little bit ago. But we won a big game and just been living the dream, getting to see the world and playing basketball at a high level. So I'm definitely enjoying everything.
Yeah, Marcus, I was going to ask you, what's it been like? I mean, is it what you thought it would be to be a professional basketball player and all the different places you've been?
Yeah, I mean, when I played at Carolina, we went to the Bahamas, and we didn't ever take, like, a big trip to Europe or anything. So this was really my first experience, like, out in the world, outside of the States. So I've really enjoyed it. Now that it's my third year in the same place, I've definitely gotten more comfortable here and gotten to see a bunch of cool cities and everything and met a lot of cool people that I never would have been able to if had I not decided to do this. It was a little interesting, like my first year getting used to being so far away from home and everything, but I would recommend it to anybody who's really wants to play at a high level, you know, and maybe on the fence or on the fringe of being an NBA player, because this experience has been great. I've ran into a bunch of guys, Dion, Marcus Aguignard, Justin Knox, like, you can run through the line of everybody, and I've crossed paths with them and everything, so it's been fun.
Marcus Aguignard, as we know, Jones, the mayor of Limoges, France,
yeah,
according
yeah.
to him and his magazines. Marcus, one of the challenges people always tell us when they're overseas is figuring out how their time relates to Tar Heel time and watching the Tar Heels. What are some of the things you've had to do to keep up with the Heels?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I just stay up. Like, I've missed the last few games of ACC play, but like earlier in the season, I caught basically every single game. You know, I saw, you know, the Texas game. I saw some of the bumps along the road, and I've seen that they started to play better recently. But even the last few seasons, I didn't necessarily play with any of these guys, but I still feel like I need to stay up and watch and follow along. And we got some group chats, like me, Luke, Kenny, Justin, Theo, like we got some different group chats where we talk about what's going on in the games and, you know, the different guys and players and everything. So even though I never played with any of them, like I still catch myself up at 2, 3 a.m. watching a game and rooting for these guys because for whatever reason, it's just I feel like I have to and I really enjoy watching the young guys play.
Marcus, part of the reason we wanted to have you on, first of all, we always love to talk with you, but part of the reason we wanted to have you on is Carolina Duke coming up on Saturday for the first meeting of the season between those two teams. From somebody who's done it at a high level in that game, what's it like being a part of one of those?
It's a great feeling. You know, I don't think there's many other comparable, you know, aspects of college basketball than a Carolina Duke week. There probably isn't one. There definitely isn't one. And you know, I was, unfortunately, we only won two games against them, but, those two wins were two of my favorite experiences in college. My sophomore year, we had the snow game where they didn't show up. And, you know, that was a really crazy experience. And then my senior year to close out the ACC title, we played them and beat them. So everybody kind of remembers those Duke games and guys can elevate their Carolina careers and have those moments where people will be talking about them forever in those games, regardless of how the season's going, regardless of how people are playing. And none of that matters as soon as it's Duke week.
One of the storylines for that game will be Carolina needing to get some good play from its young guards. That's been kind of a storyline throughout this year, is the ups and downs of the freshman guards. As someone who lived that, what advice would you give to people who are watching as Caleb Love and RJ Davis learn how to play the way Coach Williams wants them to play?
I mean, it's tough. I think people see like the five-star ranking or whatever, and they put certain expectations on them without having seen them in practice, without having seen the way they interact with coach, you know, without being able to properly evaluate how they fit with the team and all that stuff. And, you know, our fans are passionate. They love the game, and they expect results instantly, which is fine because we're a blue blood. You kind of get used to that. But at the same time, I remember as a freshman, man, I struggled until maybe 10 games left in the season. And then I kind of got comfortable and hit my stride a little bit. But I had a whole summer to work out. I was on campus. I was with Jonas. I was doing all that. And I still struggled for the vast majority of my freshman year. And at some point it clicks, but it's different for everyone. You know, Coach Rob used to tell me the same thing happened with Ty, same thing happened with Kendall, same thing happened with Ray. You know, it's not an easy job, and it's a lot of responsibility. And this year, there's a ton of talk of how talented our big man rotation is, and they're very good, and we're very deep up front. And a lot of the guards have been getting kind of they've been bearing the most of the criticism, for example. But at the same time, they have the biggest responsibility. So I say just, you know, let the young guys get their feet wet. And I love watching them play. I think Caleb's really good. The coaches kind of tell me RJ reminds them of me, which I think is cool. And I've been interested to see how he's developed and everything. So just give them a little time. And obviously they're talented. We see those moments that they have all the time. But just let them grow into that spot, because, you know, you don't always get a senior Joel Berry or, you know, Kobe White, who was just absolutely electrifying. But even him at the beginning took him a little time to adjust. So let's let these guys develop a little bit.
Somehow it was 5 years ago that Marcus Page was a senior at Carolina. That's hard to believe. Marcus, now that you've had some time away, do you look at your time in Chapel Hill or at Carolina any differently, or does it mean something different to you now than maybe right when you got out?
I think, you know, as you play professional ball, you run into a lot of guys you knew in high school, or guys that you competed against at, in any sort of level. You start to realize even more so how different the Carolina connection is. I know in my year, when I was on a two-way with Charlotte, anytime I ran into somebody who played at Carolina, whether they were, like, you know, older or someone that I was a teammate with, that connection is different. And people notice it, and people will tell you about it. They'll be like, man, you guys really, like, are about that family life. And it's like, yeah, like, we are. This is who we are. None of it is a facade or anything. And it's just funny to see people from other programs that are very prestigious be so impressed by that, because we, you know, when you're in school, you kind of take it a little bit for granted. You just assume, you know, it's the only experience you know. So you just assume maybe other schools are like that. And then you realize that not everybody got the Carolina family experience that you got, and people really wish that they had. And I know I feel that way every time I run into another player. Like I said, I saw Luke a few weeks ago. Luke came to Belgrade. He had a tough game. I went and saw him after the went to his hotel after the game. We stayed up and talked till, you know, 3, 4 a.m. just catching up on everything. And he's had a couple of great games since. But, like, just seeing each other and getting to catch up and everything really made both of our weeks. So just little stuff like that makes me more appreciative of it. As you get older, you get a little bit better perspective on your time in school. And I think now that I'm old, man, like you said, 5 years removed, I can see these young guys and, you know, try to remember back to how crazy my mind was going in all these different directions in school, and just watching them develop and knowing that, you know, knowing they're going to be all right in the end because of the guys that they get to be around every day. Our staff is so great about developing people into good men.
Marcus, did someone try and hurt you? We see the scratch, because there are about 20 Tar Heel fans that will fly over there and take down that person if they need to. What happened?
Yeah, we played Jordan Crawford tonight. He a really good scorer. He caught me with an elbow coming off a pin down. But, you know, I get cut up and beat up a lot because I'm small, so I think it makes me look a little tougher.
So you got that Tar Heel fans, you go find Jordan Crawford. No, we're just joking. Marcus, Marcus, always so great to see you, man. Appreciate you doing this. I know it's late where you are, so appreciate you staying up with us and chatting with us. Great to see you again. So glad you're having success, and always wonderful to talk with you. Hope things keep going well for you.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Great stuff, as always, from Marcus Page there. After awesome interview with Kevin Salvadori, we appreciate both of those gentlemen's time. Adam, we didn't ask Marcus Page what he wants to get into when he's done playing basketball, but if Marcus Page ever wants to come back to Carolina and somehow be involved with the Tar Heels, I support that effort because he's just awesome. A quality person, obviously a great player, and always a great time when we get a chance to talk to him.
Knows the game, but also wouldn't have to do something with coaching.
Right. No, yeah, I think he could represent Carolina in some way, and it would be great.
Yes. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if that happens once he's done playing, which for all we know, he may be embarking on a Deion Thompson-like European odyssey in which he loves it over there.
Right.
Whenever that time comes, I think it would be good for him, and it absolutely makes your program and your athletic department better when you have people like that involved.
If you could have auctioned off the ability to hang out with Luke May and Marcus Page after a EuroLeague game when they yucked it up into the late hours of the night, just reminiscing, how do you think that one would have gone?
I bet on that night Tar Heel fans' hearts swelled just a little and they weren't sure why.
Why do I feel a little extra pride? Is it the well or the bell?
For some reason, I feel warm. Glad I'm not getting a temperature scan right now. I bet Marcus and Luke are hanging out.
So again, thank you to both those guys. Really good stuff from both of them about Carolina, about themselves. That was fun. All right. We're brought to you in part by LS Tractor. Don't let your outside chores or projects cause you to miss any Tar Heel game action this year. Let LS Tractor help make short work of them. That's normal yard maintenance to larger projects as well. LS Tractor has the machine for you. That website is lstractorusa.com. LS Tractor, what's it about for you? Adam, before we get to your list, let's get to our Champions Watch, brought to you by UNC Health. Dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds and to help keep you in the game and at your very best. That's UNC Health. And the website for UNC Health is unchealthcare.org/sports. unchealthcare.org/sports. As we mentioned, I think on the last pod, bunch of stuff going on around Carolina athletics, really starting to ramp up. Adam, what's the plan this weekend?
We got to go to women's tennis today, Friday, 10 o'clock. They're facing off with Ohio State in the ITA National Team Indoors. As we have documented, Carolina's had a lot of success in that event. Chance to win another team national championship and a loaded Tar Heel team. So certainly be watching that closely this weekend.
Okay, Adam, let's get to your list.
What's on the top of Adam's list? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
So much happening in list land. We've talked about Bill Curry a couple times lately, the mouth of the South, and both Bill Walker and Downton Shabby pointed out an article by Frank DeFord, who was the best writer of his time, in Sports Illustrated in 1968. I had never seen this article, so of course I had never read it. Just a whole lot of interesting, weird stuff about Bill Curry. There's a picture of him laying in a casket in this story, in which he, that's the posed picture that they chose to do. And it just talks about what an interesting person Bill Curry was, and the way he would call games. He did all the Carolina games, but then he would fill in the other nights with other games. So it'd be like if Jones was doing the Tar Heels, but then on Thursday, the Tar Heels don't have a game, so he goes and does Wake and State. That's an interesting way to do it. It seems like people really loved him. As we've both said, he was before our time, but I enjoyed learning a little more about him, and I would commend that 1968 Sports Illustrated story to you.
I am looking forward to reading that story. I have not done so yet. I did not see when Bill Walker, he may have just sent that to you, Bill Walker. I didn't see that, but I did see when Downton Shabby sent that to us. I haven't read it yet, so I'm looking forward to reading that. But yes, the impression I've always gotten, I think you said this word, is just Bill Curry was a bit of a character and lived a very colorful existence. And so looking forward to learning more about him.
Son of Odell tweeted at us and wanted to know if we watched Saturday Night Live this past weekend. That's past my bedtime, Son of Odell. The musical performer, Machine Gun Kelly, stole Adam's social drive arm move during his first song.
Whoa.
Hey, Machine Gun Kelly.
TM, buddy.
You're on notice.
You've been TM'd, sir.
And then there was a supermarket sweep skit. I watched the supermarket sweep skit on the internet, and I would rate it about a 6 out of 10. That might be high. That might be high. I'm thinking, yeah, okay, maybe like 4.5 out of 10.
Just watching Adam, I can see the little wheels turning in Adam's mind right now.
It definitely went a different way than I was expecting. We've had all sorts of input about painting. Jared McCullen, here's what we're going to do. On next week's video pod, we'll have a whole thing about like cool Carolina things you've painted. We've done a couple things on there previously. Certainly on there will be Jared McCullen, who sent us pictures of, he did a larger Argyle on a set of cornhole boards.
This was awesome looking, I thought.
Yes. I don't understand how people do that on their own. Like, I just couldn't do it. But obviously Jared did. He says it turned out really nice, but it was a pain in the butt.
Took us.
Yeah. And he says he assures you that painting Argyle is not easy. Sean Steele wanted to know more about the Carolina Argyle border. He was just having this thought over the weekend. So send us your coolest handmade Tar Heel items, and we'll run through some of them and show them to people on the video pod, and then they will steal your ideas and take those out into the world.
To this point, Adam, do you have on your list the email we got from Agatha?
No.
About the, this is similar but different, she made the Smith Center out of Legos.
I remember seeing that.
So she said the discussion about the Smith Center puzzle that we had recently reminded her that she had meant to email this to us, that she had been bored last summer mining her 3 W's. Thank you, Agatha. Wear weight wash. Duke, wear. That she built the Smith Center out of mini bricks. They're smaller than normal Legos, and now the Smith Center lives on her desk, pictures included. What I didn't quite get is, I'm assuming this is like a kit, right? I mean, Agatha didn't just like somehow make this. I mean, because the floor is obviously Tar Heel specific. There's even a little sign that says Deanie Smith Center. So this has to be a kit, not just something that Agatha made. But I think it's awesome. Another thing that we will put on the video pod.
Yeah, I agree that whether it was a kit or not, it was impressive.
It's awesome.
But they do look like actual Legos. Like, if you look at that first picture, like, those are Legos.
Yeah, they're just mini bricks, Adam. They're smaller than usual Legos.
Nah. Okay, so yeah, that'll be on the video pod too. CarolinaInsiderPod@gmail.com. Send us all your Tar Heel items that you've made, and because we want to see them, because we know that we are not capable of doing that on our own. We got this email about the Duke game, which, as you might know, is coming up on Saturday, from Dennis Goss. And it's almost a quasi story time, but I thought it was good. Sunday, Dennis attended virtually the streaming funeral service of a great Tar Heel friend and professional mentor, Mr. Carl Scott. Carl was a UNC grad, a Rams Club member, and a huge Tar Heel basketball fan. He was among the original donors that gave gifts to help build the Smith Center. He was also a leader at the Summit Church here in the Triangle. During the eulogy, Pastor J.D. Greer told a great UNC Duke story. Carl had taken J.D. to attend a UNC Duke game. The seats overlooked the UNC players' tunnel. And J.D. watched with interest as Carl sang the fight song after the game. J.D. was familiar with the ritual, knew what was coming, and wondered if Carl, a religious man, would actually say it. To his surprise, J.D. noted that Carl was yelling out, "Go to heck Duke louder than others around him.
Took us.
The two-way counseling session that follows is, to me, hilarious. J.D. Greer, Carl, I feel like you are an elder in the church and you can't tell any group of people to go to heck. Carl, Jesus understands, he'll forgive me, and he agrees. Rusty says, Dennis says, that is classic Carl. He is one of many that will greatly miss Carl Scott. Being that this is Duke Week, he wanted to share this story in tribute to Carl. Great story. People can relate.
A quick reminder that... the podcast is brought to you in part by the Pinehurst Resort. And there's a lot more to do at the Pinehurst Resort than just Donald Ross's masterpiece, Pinehurst No. 2. There's Gil Hans's stunning redesign of No. 4. There's the Cradle, that fun short course. There's the North and South Bar with its array of bourbons, whiskeys, and scotches. Or the Pinehurst Brewing Company, where you can have a craft beer and some classic North Carolina barbecue. There has never been more to discover at the Cradle of American Golf. You can go to pinehurst.com and plan your visit. Okay, so a couple things that we have coming up. Carolina Duke, Saturday, that is 6 o'clock. Again, we'll be on the air at 5 p.m. for that one. Tar Heels and Miami, then on Monday, that's a 7 o'clock game. We'll be on the air at 6 for that one. And then the Carolina Insider that comes out on Tuesday will be Pot After Dark. A reminder, the Roy Williams Show will be on Tuesday next week, since the game is on Monday night, so we won't have a radio show, obviously, on Monday. We'll be there on Tuesday.
Rapid Reactions Pod, Monday after the game.
And there's a Rapid Reactions Pod, video pod, Monday after the game. That'll have Adam and me and CB McGrath will join us as well. So we look forward to that. Plus, there's a little football game on Sunday. Adam, is there anything else?
No.
Okay. So, we don't have, Adam, we forgot to get Marcus Page to give us a See You Later Big Grits.
That was a mistake.
Big time. But we do have Kevin Salvadori. So we're going to let Kevin Salvadori and the RZA get us out of here on the latest edition of the Carolina Insider.
I'm Kevin Salvadori. See you later, Big Grits.
When I was small, nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
See you later, Big Grit.
The preceding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Tar Heel Sports Network, brought to you by Harris Teeter, where Tar Heel fans shop for groceries.